As many of you know, Mary, the mother of Jesus, is an important figure for me. At a couple of critical junctures in my life, it's been her words in Luke's Gospel that have spoken. Let it be unto me according to your word. And for nothing will be impossible with God. And several times, especially in this final week of Advent, I've preached on Mary, on the spiritual significance of her obedience, her virginity, her humility and daring. Yet in all the years of my devotion to Mary, I've just this week realised that I've hardly given Joseph a thought. For this rather embarrassing omission, I blame Luke in the first instance. In Luke's account of the incarnation, Mary, of course, is the central character, and it's her family that's intimately involved in the unfolding of events. Mary is the one to whom the angel Gabriel appears, and it's her cousin Elizabeth who has also recently and improbably conceived a child to be called John, whom Elizabeth's husband, Zechariah, recognises as the forerunner of the Messiah. During her pregnancy, Mary is said to stay with her cousin Elizabeth about 3 months, and while she's there, she proclaims the meaning of it all in her Magnificat. At Jesus' birth and afterwards, Joseph is, of course, present in Luke's story. As in Matthew, he's the reason the birth takes place in Bethlehem, because he was descended from the house and family of David. He's there, too, when the shepherds visit at the prompting of the angelic host. But it's Mary who is said to ponder their words in her heart. And so it goes. According to Luke, when, as a couple, they present their infant son at the temple, it's Mary who is warned by Simeon that a sword will pierce her soul also. And at a later visit to the temple, it's Mary who reproaches Jesus when he stays behind after the festival. "Child, why have you treated us like this? Look, your father and I have been searching for you with great anxiety." To which Jesus is said to reply, in words that no doubt contribute to Joseph's erasure, "Why were you searching for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's, with a capital F, house?" As in, you know. The words of the carol, "Born in the night, Mary's child," just about sums it up from Luke's perspective. Which is why it's a bit of a shock to realise that in Matthew's account of Jesus' conception and birth, it's almost completely the other way round. The first 17 verses of Matthew's Gospel are comprised of a genealogy that traces Jesus' ancestry patrilineally. From Abraham, the father of Israel, through David, Israel's archetypal king, down to Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom Jesus was born. On this account, Jesus' messianic credentials come, in the first instance, through Joseph's family line. And thus it is to Joseph, not Mary, that the angel, appearing in a dream, announces the miracle of Jesus' conception. In marked contrast to Luke, Matthew's Mary is given no direct explanation for her pregnancy and no speaking part at all. Joseph is the one who is given to name the child Jesus. And after the birth, it's Joseph who will be key to the child's survival. For, like his distant relative, Joseph, son of Jacob, he of the coat of many colours, This Joseph, the husband of Mary, is an interpreter of dreams. And three more times an angel of the Lord appears to him in his dreams, first warning him to flee from Herod's murderous rampage, then commanding him to bring his family back to Israel after Herod has died, and ultimately instructing him to settle in Nazareth where the child might grow to maturity. And each time Joseph did as he was commanded. He got up, took the child and his mother, and got on with it. Well, at one level, Matthew's take on the circumstances of the incarnation isn't surprising. He is the evangelist most obviously concerned with emphasising how Jesus is the fulfilment of God's promise to Israel. Matthew reminds us time and time again that this happened to Jesus, or Jesus did or said this or that, so that the scriptures, meaning the Hebrew scriptures, might be fulfilled. According to commentators, this isn't because Matthew was looking for random Old Testament proof texts that Jesus might somehow fulfil. Rather, he's thinking about the shape of Israel's story and linking Jesus' life with key passages that promise this same consistency of God's redemptive love for God's people. As scholar Stanley Hauerwas puts it, for Matthew, Jesus is identified as the son of David, the son of Abraham, because he is the one who recapitulates Israel's life. He is the renewing of the law, the promise of the land and the temple. He is the long-awaited king, the restoration of all that makes Israel the promised people. So, Hauerwas goes on, through Joseph's adoption, Jesus stands in the line of David. Jesus is thus the climax of Matthew's genealogical story of Israel's past, at once representing that story while profoundly transforming the very categories of its existence. Or, as Matthew himself expresses it, Joseph, son of David, do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife. She will bear a son, and you are to name him Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfil what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet. Lo, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall name him Emmanuel, which means God is with us. So far, so profoundly patriarchal. Yet there's another dimension to Joseph's way of being in this gospel that I find fascinating. The church often speaks, and I've often spoken, of Mary as an icon of obedience, integrity, humility. Through her yes to God, as Rowan Williams once put it, there is a new release of God's presence and power. There is more room for God because the usual obstacles to God's work in self-preoccupation and fear and resentment have been overcome in Mary's unswerving willingness to absorb the vision God has given. But isn't all this just as true of Joseph? As for Mary, his expectations for his life are being summarily overthrown. By her pregnancy, he is humiliated, rendered vulnerable to the judgment of his neighbours, left to deal with his own doubts and fears in the light of, let's face it, a fairly sparse divine communique delivered by way of a dream. 4th century theologian John Chrysostom praised Joseph as a man of exceptional self-restraint, since he must have been free of that most tyrannical passion, jealousy. Or as we might express it today, free of the assumptions of entitlement and possession. As with Mary, Joseph displays the most profound humility. In fact, he is so humble, so self-effacing, that we don't even remember to honour his self-effacingness. I've just confessed I've never noticed him at all. How's that for the profound subversion of a patriarchal culture organised around male concern for male honour and shame? In this sense, Joseph, no less than Mary, prefigures the kenosis, the radical self-emptying of Christ on the cross. So who then is Joseph? What might his meaning be for us? Well, notice that in the story he does not utter a word. In fact, there is no report of his direct speech in any of the Gospels. It doesn't mean he's not involved, active, present. Indeed, according to Matthew, he seems tuned in at the deepest level of his being, in his dreams and in his body, to the divine speech. And when he becomes aware of it, he responds simply and without drama to what is asked of him. He plays his part. But again, notice that though crucial, it is in fact the part of a minor character. Joseph is not the one who bears the child. He's not the one to redeem Israel, or even the one who gets to announce the child's meaning. His role is essentially to protect the space of possibility and enable the action of others. We don't even know when he fades out of the story, just that after the narratives of Jesus' childhood, we never hear of him again. There's a compulsion many of us feel to make a difference in the world. We're brought up on heroic tales of the power of one, stories of charismatic individuals who galvanise social movements for justice and freedom. Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu, Greta Thunberg and Grace Tame. And such people are extraordinary and do make a difference and are rightly honoured. But there are others of us whose primary contribution may be to realise that we're not the main actor in any given situation. Not the one called to make the obviously decisive difference. That doesn't mean we just leave everything up to those we deem more qualified or more exceptional than ourselves. But it does mean being willing to get out of the way when necessary. To let go the compulsion to assert our necessity or usefulness. Or to insert ourselves out of anxiety or good intentions at the centre of events. It means being so attuned to the divine communication that we can play our part, and it may look to be a very minor part in enabling God's action in the world. Because ultimately, that's what really matters. Both Matthew and Luke insist that the incarnation is God's doing. She was found to be with child from the Holy Spirit. In the end, All that matters is that we are open to discern what God is doing, what life wants of us, and how we are called to participate in that. Anything else just gets in the way. At Christmas, we remember the myriad ways in which the whole community in heaven and on earth was invited to recognise, celebrate, and respond to the divine action. Angels and shepherds, oxen and magi, Elizabeth and Zechariah, Simeon and Anna, Mary, the Mother of God, and Joseph, who was a righteous man, a lover of his family, and quietly, undramatically, perhaps even unknown to himself, a participant in the salvation of the world.